You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, state lawmakers are working on a constitutional amendment that would limit the veto powers of Wisconsin governors. We'll talk about the latest conflict between state Republicans and Governor Tony Evers.
Now, many industries lobby members of Congress for legislation that helps them and against measures that hurt them. But few have had the influence and political power that the tobacco industry did in its heyday.
Smoking has been a big part of American culture over many decades, but the political support of the industry often flew under the radar, and the general public was not always aware.
Sarah Mylov is an assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia. She's the author of The Cigarette, A Political History. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a really interesting topic and a really big part of American history. Tobacco is a uniquely American crop. When was it first grown on the continent?
Well, tobacco is the story of America insofar as colonists were growing it at Jamestown, sometimes in lieu of growing food. So it's really been part of American history, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years. But the story of the cigarette itself as a product, doesn't really get going until the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
And so how did tobacco and cigarettes gain such political clout in the United States?
Yeah, so in the late 19th century, it's a period of economic consolidation, economic growth, urbanization, and within tobacco, the man that stands out as really the robber baron for tobacco is a man by the name of James B. Duke of Duke University fame. And Duke really ends up cornering the market on the technological process that allows for the mechanization of cigarettes, so that cigarettes were once rolled by children, by hand, in factories. Under the Duke Trust, it ends up being produced by machines and therefore more cheaply. And that's kind of the genesis of the smoking industry. But what really happens, the significant thing that happens, is the First World War. Wars are crucially important to the domestication of tobacco and making smoking socially acceptable.
So tell us about that. There are all of these American soldiers who have gone over to Europe to fight in what was not then known as the First World War, but we know it as that now. How did tobacco play into their experience?
You know, I think one thing many people might be surprised to learn is that prior to the 1930s, when Americans consumed tobacco, they were not likely at all to consume it in a cigarette. They were much more likely to chew it, to smoke it in a pipe, to maybe nurse it in a cigar. That smoking a mechanically produced cigarette was considered an immigrant vice. It was actually a foreign import into the United States. The people who did that were the people living in cities frequently. Cigarette smoking was associated with kind of juvenile delinquency. There was kind of a eugenic inflected temperance movement against cigarettes. And before the United States entered World War I, a handful of states had even passed laws prohibiting the sale of cigarettes in their state, which, you know, it really was surprising for me to learn before I became steeped in this research. But the war changes all of that. And in part, it's because cigarette smoking is the kind of vice that seems rather tame in comparison to other vices, let's say young men could get up to out there on the European front. And so you see organizations like the YMCA and the Red Cross, both of which played a really important part as civil service organizations during the war, going from opposing cigarette consumption for young people to during the war actually helping to raise funds to buy soldiers cigarettes and handing out cigarettes at canteens.
Well, and what we know about one of the effects of smoking tobacco is a calming effect. People will sometimes smoke because they're feeling anxious or nervous. And certainly what we know now about the horrors of World War One and the first really documented cases of PTSD, which they called
shell shock.
Thank you. It's not surprising that it would have become a pretty popular habit as well.
Right. I mean, smoking is something that you can do to calm the nerves, to do something with your hands. You can do it quietly with your fellow soldiers. There's kind of a solidarity in lighting up a cigarette together. And then again, it's also something you can do in solitude if you need a moment to yourself. So it's not hard to understand why maybe the Army would have encouraged or at least not discouraged cigarette consumption for soldiers at the front.
We're talking with Sarah Mylove right now. She's an assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia. We're talking about her new book, The Cigarette, A Political History. And you can join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-642-1234. And Sarah, you talked about that in World War One. It was certainly the case in World War Two as well. Can you share some of the other ways that the tobacco industry and the federal government really supported each other and were in this very symbiotic relationship?
Yeah, so one way the federal government worked to support tobacco was through a very extensive and very generous subsidy program for tobacco growers. And that gets started during the New Deal, during the 1930s. And the philosophy here is that agriculture was then centrally important to the American economy. And if you wanted to get people in factories working again, people in the countryside also had to have incomes, that the American economic sectors were interrelated. And so it was important to get agriculture back up on its feet. And so for tobacco, what was inaugurated was a very extensive program of supply management, so restricting very rigidly the amount of tobacco that could be grown, and a very generous system of price support. So ensuring, kind of like a minimum wage, that any farmer who brought his tobacco to auction would be assured a minimum price. And this program of supply management and subsidy lasted a remarkably long time. It lasted until 2004. So that is 5 decades, 50 years after the Surgeon General issued the report on the famous report on smoking and health in 1964.
And that subsidy lasting so many decades, is that unusual? Are they usually more short-term boosts for industries instead of an ongoing kind of infusion?
Well, tobacco was a particularly long-lived, even within the context of agricultural subsidies. So in the 1980s and 1990s, there were major revisions to farm laws, but because of the importance of, in a sense, Southern Democrats in the 1930s, the tobacco program was actually written separately from the rest of the farm bills. So tobacco already always had kind of a separate kind of largesse applied to it. And so even though many other forms of subsidy, many other forms of direct subsidy and support ended for many farmers in the 1990s, tobacco held on until, a decade later.
What about individual politicians who were really the standard bearers for continued support of tobacco much longer than perhaps it would have lasted without them?
Well, there was a very prominent within tobacco world representative, a man by the name of Harold Cooley, who represented a tobacco growing district in North Carolina. And this once again speaks to the power of really Southern Democrats for the middle decades of the 20th century. Cooley ends up being the longest serving chair on the House Agricultural Committee, a very powerful committee, particularly in the middle decades, the mid 20th century. He's the longest serving chair even to this date. He served for nearly uninterrupted for 3 decades. Through his ability to decide, what gets debated, what even rises to the issue, rises to the level of a political issue in front of his committee, you know, he's able to steward the program for quite a long time.
Well, and I was very interested to learn that Jesse Helms, who was a longtime Republican senator from North Carolina, was actually news director for the Tobacco Radio Network before he went to Congress. So clearly he, too, was very much in front of that.
Yeah, Jesse Helms plays a really interesting role in the 1980s, though perhaps some farmers in the 1980s might have seen him more as a friend to the cigarette manufacturers rather than their particular champion.
We're talking with Sarah Mylove right now. She's an assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia. She's the author of The Cigarette, A Political History.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a current or former smoker, how did you originally start? Did you ever feel manipulated by advertising or powerful interests that supported the industry? What changes have you seen in the tobacco industry, the way it relates to the government, and what questions do you have for our guest about this political history of cigarettes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org.
Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Sarah Mylove right now. She's an assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia and the author of the new book, The Cigarette, A Political History.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you smoke? Did you? What's your take on how dominant the tobacco industry has been, or at least once was, in the United States? If you're a non-smoker, what's it been like being able to work in and patronize non-smoking businesses? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And let's go to the phones. And Roy in Portage is up. Hi, Roy.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing?
Good. What would you like to share?
Well, years ago when I first joined the military, go out on maneuvers, part of the sea rations that they would give us, it had a little package with three cigarettes and a pack of matches in it. So, you know, in a way, the military kind of helped a lot of people start smoking. And I smoked for 25 years before I gave it up.
Oh, thanks for that call, Roy. And so Sarah really illustrating that point of cigarettes being presented and given to service people.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And service people tend to be young men. And that's when, you know, we know that people become addicted to cigarettes. So the marriage between government, the military, and youth was clearly very important for many people to begin the habit. And, you know, military bases for even after cigarettes were no longer included in rations, continued to sell tobacco products at a discount.
Thanks for that call, Roy. Let's go back to the phones, and Michael in St. Paul is up. Hi, Michael.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call, and congratulations, Professor, on the new book.
Thank you.
You had said something earlier that caused the hair on the back of my neck to stand up about cigarette smoking being calming. And I know it's 2019. We're all very aware about the health effects. But that calming that you mentioned, that has to do with addiction. So looking at in terms of addiction, the reason that there's a, quote-unquote, a relaxing sensation is because your nicotine receptors in the brain are being satisfied by that craving.
Thank you for that clarification. I was speaking as a non-smoker, so I appreciate you clarifying that. And, you know, the addiction element is definitely a big part of the story, isn't it, Sarah?
Yeah, I'm so glad for that call and that intervention. I think that for non-smokers, it sounds paradoxical, but for smokers, you know, the necessity of calming is because of addiction itself. It's because of the craving and the need to be satisfied.
And let's talk a little bit about how the tide kind of turned against the ubiquitous nature of tobacco, the government and popular support for the products. You talk about non-smokers advocating and agitating for freedom from secondhand smoke. You refer to it as a conflict between the organized few and the disorganized many. What did you mean by that?
I mean, if you look at the trajectory of tobacco over the 20th century, what it looks like if you kind of take 100 years looking at it together is the government, the federal government, supported organized producers, whether the industry or tobacco growers, for a very long time, and it took a supreme amount of effort from individual citizens who essentially formed a social movement and used the language of rights to say, you know, where can we see vindication for the way we want to live? And so you really see a tide turning, not with the Surgeon General's report in 1964, not when the federal government says this is tobacco or cigarette smoking causes cancer, but you really start to see it when social movements mobilize in the 1970s to say, you know, whatever the smoker wants to do is fine in his business. That's not even what we're arguing anymore. We're arguing whether or not you can smoke in front of me. And so these social movements that basically invent the idea of a non-smoker, that there is a class of people that could be called non-smokers and that they should have rights, they form groups. These groups have kind of funny acronym names. The primary non-smokers rights group is called GASP, Group Against Smoke and Pollution. And they basically began lobbying city councils and eventually winning local ordinances that say that begin to restrict where people can smoke in public places.
As a result of many lawsuits and eventual legal victories against big tobacco, people on the whole found out a lot more about the lobbying and marketing efforts of mm-hmm. big tobacco that were often targeted at minority communities and more vulnerable populations. And it was really interesting that even at a point when research was clearly pointing to the public health concerns of smoking, there was such a strong lobby and governmental support for that tobacco industry. Here's a clip from the 2005 film Thank You for Smoking, where a lobbyist for big tobacco is having dinner with alcohol and gun lobbyists.
Look, I mean, nothing personal, but tobacco generates a little more heat than alcohol.
Oh, this is news.
Well, my product puts away 475,000 a year.
Oh, okay, now 475 is a legit number.
Okay, 435,000, that's 1,200 a day. How many alcohol-related deaths a year?
Well,
100,000 tops? Well, that's what, 270 a day? Wowee. 270 people, the tragedy. Excuse me if I don't exactly see terrorists getting excited about kidnapping anyone from the alcohol industry.
So three lobbyists trying to outdo each other
the death lobby.
Yeah, the death. Yeah, exactly. So this was a very big factor that at the time, a lot of people weren't aware was going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, I think one of the most striking things about tobacco and the reason why writers and journalists and commentators can refer to the tobacco playbook was the remarkable fact of the litigation in the 90s and early 2000s has led to this trove of documents that were produced as part of the legal process of discovery. That huge trove of documents is now publicly available on an online archive. So everybody in the world has access to the inner workings of this industry in a way that we simply don't have for really any other industry. So, you know, tobacco is frequently held up as the playbook that every other industry is, you know, modeling themselves after when they try to lobby. But that might just be an artifact of the fact that we only really know a ton about tobacco because of all of these documents.
We're talking with Sarah Mylov about her new book, The Cigarette, A Political History. And let's go back to the phones, and Owen in Wauwega is up. Hi, Owen.
Yes. Hi, Jude. How are you?
Good.
I appreciate you guys taking my call. When I was about 10 years old, I really got interested in collecting the old illustrated advertisements that were found in magazines in Grandma's attic. And then, you know, I continued to find and look for those old illustrated advertisements. I really enjoy the colors and really beautiful. And started in the 1920s and up until the 50s is my favorite period. And I still have a lot of those old prints stored away. But I actually got the pleasure of working in the tobacco fields in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, and that is hard work, and it's one of the only farming practices that's still completely unmechanized. It's all done by hand, much like they did it when they started harvesting tobacco you know, 100 and something years ago.
Thanks for that call, Owen. We're running just a little short on time. And the advertising is a really interesting aspect, Sarah. There was once the shift went from this is an immigrant degenerate kind of habit to this is sophisticated and classy. That was a big attraction, wasn't it?
Well, and that was all due to advertising. So really, the advertising industry in the United States and the tobacco industry in the United States are absolutely intertwined. All of the big ad firms are getting tobacco dollars to fuel their growth and their expansion during the 1920s. And that, in part, is resting on the fact that during that decade, there were major tax cuts. So the tobacco industry is able to put more money into advertising.
And Sarah, briefly, as we start to wrap up, what kind of clout does the tobacco industry have today? Is it waning or is it still holding relatively stable?
That's a really, really interesting question. In a way, tobacco's influence lingers secondhand, if you pardon the pun, even though its lobbying outlays are nowhere near what they were even 10 years ago. And its influence lingers because people are still addicted to tobacco. It is still the leading preventable cause of death in the United States, responsible for nearly 500,000 excess deaths each year. And, you know, to add to that, on top of it now, in terms of the e-cigarette issue, which is now emerging as a new major important public health issue, the largest e-cigarette firm is Juul, which is Big Tobacco. Mm-hmm. Philip Morris, Altria now, owns a 35% stake in it. So tobacco and the addictive industries are not going away.
Well, Sarah, thanks so much for joining us today. It was a really interesting conversation.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Sarah Mylove is an assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia. She's the author of the new book, The Cigarette, A Political History.
Coming up, we'll look at state Republicans' push to prevent governors from using their veto pens to increase spending in state budgets. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guest look at the state of abortion and reproductive rights legislation in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow morning at 7, right here on the Ideas Network.
Now, state Republican lawmakers are trying to limit the veto powers of Wisconsin governors.
They're pushing for a constitutional amendment that would prevent governors from using their veto pen to increase spending.
In the state budget he signed in July, Evers used his partial veto authority to give public schools a $65 million boost. Republicans introduced the amendment a few days later. A hearing took place this past Tuesday.
And in related news, the state Supreme Court has agreed to hear a separate challenge that would scale back the governor's veto powers.
Mordecai Lee is a professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. Mordecai, good to have you back.
Thanks for inviting me, Rob.
Well, we talked to you a few months back when this constitutional amendment was first introduced. Before we dig into it and the latest on it, remind us how the governor of Wisconsin's veto authority stacks up compared to their colleagues around the country.
Well, generally speaking, we look at the Wisconsin governor's power of line item veto as exceptionally broad, that he or she can veto out words and sentences of any bill that affects money. In other words, not just an appropriations bill, but perhaps, let's say, a bonding bill or a retirement bill or something like that. And it's only been in our generation that there have been the most modest kinds of limitations on governors that have been passed by constitutional amendments. And so what we're talking about today in terms of what the Republican legislature is doing sort of fits in what I guess I'd call a secular trend of trying to define down a little bit more of the governor's powers.
Let's talk about the specific change here. The governor increased funding with a veto, which does sound, you veto, you think you take something out. This added some money. Does that fit into the current power of the governor as you see it?
Well, apparently there are a couple of instances where Tommy Thompson, who really used line item veto powers to the max, had that same effect of increasing funding for a program. But I think if we can set aside partisanship, which is sort of hard to do these
sure,
days.
Easy peasy.
But when you look at the Constitution and it talks about partial vetoes, in other words, the word part of a whole, I think that the legislature can make something of an argument that increasing funding for a program is not a part of a whole, it's an addition to a whole. So I think there's something of merit there, but there's so much of an overlay of institutional attacks and partisan attacks that it's really hard to get down to the merits of the matter.
Right. This is a case where Republicans are working to limit the power of a Democratic governor. Back in the days of Tommy Thompson, I know Democratic lawmakers who had a majority at many points there were upset about the Republican governor using these powers. Have we had moments where people sit back and say, okay, let's think about this outside of the bounds of partisanship and how much power a governor should have?
Well, it seems to me that when we look back at the earlier constitutional amendments, one of them was called the Vanna White veto. I was in the legislature at the time. It was the late 80s. That meant that you couldn't strike out a letter to create new words. That sort of struck me. I supported it. That struck me as relatively decent. The Frankenstein veto, the one that came from the Republican legislature when Governor Doyle was governor, said that you can't create new sentences. You can only line on a veto out a whole sentence or words within a sentence. That started to get to some significant limitations. But we probably have to be sure that we keep our eye on the institutional factor and the partisan factor of how we in Wisconsin amend our state constitution. And just a reminder to listeners, I guess this is my five-second mini-lecture, that the way our state constitution gets amended is it has to pass the state legislature in two subsequent legislatures, in other words, an intervening election. And if it passes two legislatures, then it goes straight to the voters. And the significant detail that's not verbalized is the fact that a governor plays no role. We're used to governors being able to veto things or line on to veto things. A governor can't stop a constitutional amendment. And so it was a very shrewd tactic by a Republican legislature when they wanted to ban single-sex marriage during Governor Doyle's administration by pursuing it through a constitutional amendment because he couldn't stop it. And so I think that very much is in play when we wonder why does a legislature so frequently tilt towards changing things through a constitutional amendment instead of through a law.
Well, but in this case, too, is the power of the veto defined by the Constitution? Can it be changed without a constitutional amendment?
No, I think you're right to emphasize that. With the courts interpreting the word part or partial the way they have in the past, indeed, it would require a much more explicit kind of constitutional amendment that explains it. The same thing happened when we legalized gambling, and it was interpreted by courts as meaning that Indian gambling in all respects was now constitutionalized. And then a much more detailed verbal constitutional amendment had to be passed to clarify it. So, yes, you're right. This is Civics 101. The only way to change the Constitution is to change the Constitution.
Talking to Mordecai Lee, Emeritus Professor at UW-Milwaukee, looking at a proposed change, a proposed constitutional amendment limiting the governor of Wisconsin's veto power, saying, in effect, he can't add spending to a state budget using the veto power. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on that and the power of the governor relative to the legislature. 800-642-1234 is the number. Mordecai, on a related note now, the state Supreme Court says it'll hear a challenge to state veto rules and nullify, or in this case, if they upheld it, would nullify four of Evers' budget vetoes. And here's a statement from Rick Essenberg, who heads up the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. They're a conservative group representing taxpayers in this challenge. They say the people of Wisconsin never intended the check on legislative power the governor's veto represents to permit the governor to legislate on his own. So, okay, there's this constitutional amendment over here. Here are these court challenges going straight to the state Supreme Court on the other. What do you think of this challenge?
Well, I think this is ideology and partisanship. I'm really reluctant to say it, but it's come to a point in our generation where the Supreme Court has become a partisan institution. When candidates run for Supreme Court, there's a de facto Republican nominee and there's a de facto Democratic nominee. And right now we have a conservative majority, a 5-2 conservative majority. And I regret that their decision-making seems to be becoming relatively reflexive. In other words, if this helps Republicans, we're for it. If this helps Democrats, we're against it. It's a sad state of affairs. I wish it wasn't that. But ever since the decision about Act 10, where they really sort of went through legal contortions to argue that the state's open meetings law did not apply to the legislature, even though the legislature passed the law saying it did, ever since then, I'm afraid we've ended up with a partisan, predictable, ideological voting pattern on the court.
Based on that, what do you think would be the outcome of this challenge then?
5-2. I'm really sorry to say it, and if I've just hurt the feelings of any Supreme Court members who are listening, I do apologize. But we have yet to see them taking issues so much on the merits that they really have a major disagreement with a Republican philosophy.
Yeah, when I've interviewed members of the Supreme Court on either side of that divide, they push back on that idea that they're Republicans or Democrats. Their judicial ideology happens often to line up with one side or another, they'd say. But you know, couldn't you see a case where they really look at the institutions here, how the power of the executive and the legislature weigh against each other and consider this case on those merits?
Rob, I think that's a good scenario. And all things being equal, I wish that were the case, and I hope that's the case. But the fact that the Supreme Court took the case on original jurisdiction, in other words, they didn't let it go up the chain from the trial court to the Court of Appeals to them, I think is a signal that they've sort of made up their minds. They want to act on this, they want to act on it fast, and they know how they're going to act. So I'm afraid that them taking the jurisdiction is probably an indication of political reality.
Yeah, Jill Karofsky, who's running for the state Supreme Court, is campaigning on this issue in her campaign email. She says a right-wing group filed the lawsuit and immediately asked the Supreme Court to skip all the steps that these types of lawsuits normally follow. So, yeah, usually in the court system, you start at the little court, the local court, and ease your way up until you hit the Supreme Court, whether that's at the state or national level. We jumped right to the Supreme Court here. Is that problematic?
Well, it's legal, and so for all of your listeners wondering if they've broken any court rules, they have not broken it. And every once in a while, the state Supreme Court will take original jurisdiction. But I think it's noteworthy that they took this one and they took it so fast, and that it has the appearance of them wanting to quickly affirm a conservative ideological position.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Wauwatosa. Tom, hi.
Hey, Rob. Hey, Mordecai. I talked to you guys last time this issue was on the radio. Mordecai, I'm a former student, if you recall.
Sure.
I'm still just going to reiterate and rehash my point from last time. I think we need to get the adults back in the room, and we need to start figuring out some compromises, because as soon as the party who's in control of the legislature changes or the governor changes, we're going to be going through the same fiasco all over again. We're starting to look ridiculous, and we need to get some statesmen back in here. And I believe, as you said last time, find a way to compromise and go, okay, here's half a loaf, here's half a loaf. Are you good? Good. Not exactly, but you got something? Okay, let's keep it moving.
Tom, thanks for the call. Mordecai?
Well, Tom is right, and I give him an A, a follow-up to the course he took. But I think if we tried to figure out what would it take to change the nature of the membership of the Supreme Court so that we have legal scholars who are considered nonpartisan or considered fine scholars, the way we have it now is it's a de facto election based on partisanship. The way they do it in Washington is a president nominates someone, and then the U.S. Senate either confirms or rejects them. I don't think that's worked out very well either, whether one is a Democrat or Republican, in terms of the quality of the court. I've seen proposals that there be some kind of a nonpartisan nominating commission that would nominate finalists and then have some political process based on that. Maybe that's the way to get to what Tom and I would be hoping for, but it's a long shot, and I'm probably being idealistic.
We're talking about state Republicans' efforts to rein in the power of the governor. Mordecai Lee is with us, professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker himself.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Should governors be allowed to use their veto pens to increase spending? How do you feel about a constitutional amendment to prohibit that practice? Are Republicans right to roll back governor's powers, or is this sour grapes because Scott Walker lost? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We continue our conversation with Mordecai Lee. He's an emeritus professor at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. We're talking about state Republicans' efforts to limit the power of the governor. They're working on a constitutional amendment that would ban governors from using their veto power to increase spending.
Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Did Governor Evers abuse his veto power when he gave schools a funding bump, a boost with his veto pen? Do you want to see a constitutional amendment to prohibit this, or should Republicans have just tried to override that veto? What questions do you have about governor's veto authority or Republicans' efforts to rein in that power, as well as other powers of the governor? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Paul is with us in Burlington. Paul, hi.
Hello. Yes, I'd like to make a comment regarding the throttling of the governor's powers. It seems to me that it is sour grapes, and that I'm not sure, maybe because there's fewer Republicans, but Republicans in general just are starting to come across as like, hey, if we can't get it done this way, we're gonna do it another way, which almost seems like cheating in some aspects as far as gerrymandering, which I know Democrats do as well. But this particular instance with Scott Walker, it just feels like sour grapes. And at one point, do the people of Wisconsin say, like, hey, we're not getting what we want because of all this tinkering? And, do the Democrats do it next?
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. And people have thrown into the mix the lame duck session back in December, where some powers of the attorney general and governor were limited. Rules changes, making it easier for the assembly at least to keep having votes on veto overrides. Is there a trend here, Mordecai?
I think there's a trend here. I think in this case, we could look at a kind of the culture of the Republican Party, which is much more feisty, much more willing to do things that might appear unpopular, that might really look aggressive, compared to maybe the culture of the Democratic Party is a little bit more moderate, a little bit more towards compromise. Certainly, if we look at Governor Evers, when he had the option of vetoing the budget because the state legislature would not compromise with him about the big issues, and he opted not to, that was a real indication of blinking from a political point of view, if one wants to follow Paul's scenario. Going back to Tom's comment, wouldn't it have been better if the state legislature, there were conservative Republicans and this left-of-center Democratic governor, would have compromised about school aids, would have compromised about these other issues? That's the world that I would like to see. But I'm afraid we're stuck in this, and it becomes just this cycle of, I don't know what to call it, just cycle of popping each other back and forth.
Thanks a lot for that call. And yeah, there were these recent rule changes I just mentioned in the assembly that would allow multiple votes to override vetoes. And under Wisconsin's constitution, a veto override is a two-thirds majority, I think, of those present at the vote. And that's conjured for Democrats a worry that we might see something like in North Carolina, where Republicans voted on a veto override while many Democrats were at a 9/11 memorial event. Are we going to end up there, Mordecai?
Well, it's possible. Certainly, Speaker Voss is an aggressive politician, and he's unapologetic about trying to maximize his leverage. The thing that surprised me about that is that for the few of us who remember parliamentary procedure, there's a very standard element of parliamentary procedure where it's called the division of the question. Division of the question means we'll take one vote at a time on one issue at a time. And so it really strikes me as going against one of the principles of parliamentary procedure to refuse to unbundle this kind of a vote. And I really wish that hadn't happened. It would be sort of unnatural, I guess one would say, from a point of view of parliamentary procedure to do it. But Speaker Voss is certainly willing to defend it.
Talking to Mordecai Lee, Emeritus Professor at UW-Milwaukee, looking at the governor's veto power in Wisconsin and efforts in the Republican-led legislature to limit that power. Back to your calls now. Joan is with us in Eau Claire. Joan, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. The Republicans that were in the legislature when Scott Walker was in office, they bent and bowed to every whim of Scott Walker. I find this to be extremely hypocritical because now that they have to do some compromising, they really aren't doing any compromising. It's kind of like a dream compromise is at this point. They want to take power away from him. It's very telling, and I just think they're trying to shove their weight around, and maybe that's just Voss, but I find them hypocritical. They should be ashamed of themselves, really, and thank you for allowing me to speak.
Joan, thanks for the call. There were some thoughts from Republicans and from Governor Evers that because Governor Evers is there with the veto override, that Republicans approved some things in the budget that they might not have otherwise.
Well, I think the budget was largely what the Republicans wanted and largely what Evers did not want. They really gave him very little. Maybe the way to build on Joan's observation is if you go back to Governor Walker's last budget, and he had, I think it was about 50 or 60 line item vetoes. Several of those line item vetoes said he was vetoing something because he felt they impinged on the power of the executive, the power of the governor to run the executive branch. And so if one wants to accept the premise of what Joan was talking about, the fact that the Republican legislature did not object to line item vetoes that had to do with the power of a governor versus the power of the legislature was an indication that their partisan solidarity, their ideological solidarity, trumped their institutional concerns. And that is a dispiriting kind of phenomenon.
Thanks for that call. We heard from Joel on Facebook who wrote, Wisconsin has long had an extremely generous line item veto compared to most states. In the traditional sense, a veto was supposed to only allow a particular part of a budget to be removed from the budget. I think, Joel writes, we need to go back to that definition with the full knowledge. It'll be enforced on all governors, regardless of party affiliation. And that's how I usually understand the line item veto. You're going to veto this, you know, the corrections budget because you don't like it. You're going to sign off on the rest of it. We go back to that big chunk of budget. You're not vetoing this one line to tweak its meaning.
Well, Joel is right. But if you were to ask the average Wisconsinite, what does it mean for a governor to be able to have a partial line item veto and the focus of Supreme Court decisions on the word part, then that would tell us that because the governor can only do it in financial bills, that therefore it's about money, that you can reduce $1 million to $100,000 or to $10,000 or to $10. That would be a very traditional orientation that Joel is talking about. Governor Thompson was a pioneer in saying that if there's $1 million appropriation, that he could write in the digit 9, in other words, to change $1 million into $900,000, and he argued successfully to the court that $900,000 is a part of $1 million, and therefore he could write in new digits. And I guess you'd say that from those kind of aggressive interpretations that Joel is right, that we've moved far away from a kind of a conventional understanding of what it meant to reduce appropriations.
Well, maybe next time we'll get some of your former colleagues in the philosophy department to talk about that. Mordecai, thanks as always for joining us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Rob.
That's Mordecai Lee, professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. We talked with him about state Republicans' push to block governors from using their veto authority to increase spending. They're proposing a constitutional amendment, which could be voted on by a Senate committee next week, clearing the way for a full Senate vote. You can join in the conversation still over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A lot of people weighing in on the idea, the proposal over there. Do that at the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR with your thoughts.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, California just mandated later school start times. We'll find out why they made the move and what research shows.
A new survey finds manufacturing job cuts here in Wisconsin. We'll ask a Wisconsin economist if that's a one-time blip or maybe part of a bigger ongoing trend and what the future could hold for the state's big and pretty economically important manufacturing sector.
And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We will be welcoming Samin Nosrat, author of the cookbook and star of the Netflix series Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. She is coming to Wisconsin for an event next week. Rob, have you gotten to see some of the show?
I have not seen the show. I'm looking forward to talking about the cookbook, and I like the philosophy of what you plug in where to balance things out. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.